Chapter 7. Marco. June 1937. Marco watched dust motes swirl in a shaft of sunlight, while his classmates were getting their essays from their backpacks. The classroom was stifling, small, and devoid of decoration other than the Italian flag, a large wooden crucifix, and portraits of King Vittorio Emanuele III and Il Duce. A sign bore the party credo: credere, obbedire, combattere. Believe, obey, fight. There were 30 other students in his class, including Elisabetta and Sandro, all dressed in their uniforms. Their teacher, Professoressa Longhi, was an older woman with thick glasses and gray hair in a bun, thick-waisted in her dark dress, which sported the tricolor emblem. She motioned for them to sing Giovinezza, the party anthem, and the class rose half-heartedly, weary of the routine this late in the school year. She didn't reprimand them, and Marco suspected she had joined the party only to keep her job, as she had noticed her rolling her eyes at their textbooks from time to time. The standard joke was that some teachers joined the PNF, the Partito Nazionale Fascista, but others joined per necessità familiare, only to support their family. Secretly, he felt the same way, a fascist because of his father, and it was the only way he knew. At heart, he believed in love, not politics. Marco began to sing with his classmates, loudly to make Elisabetta laugh. Your warrior's valor, your pioneer's virtue, Alighieri's vision, today shines in every heart. Marco turned around to see if Elisabetta was laughing, but instead she was looking at Sandro, whose desk was near the front. Her face bore a curious expression, one that Marco hadn't seen before, and he had seen all of her expressions. She lifted her right eyebrow when she listened. She frowned when she read the newspaper, and she wrinkled the bridge of her nose when she laughed hard. She could even look dreamy-eyed, like when she watched the screen at the movies. Oddly, she was looking that way now, at Sandro. Marco felt bewildered, remembering the afternoon that he had seen Sandro and Elisabetta standing close at the river. What if something had happened between them? Were they becoming more than friends? Neither of them had told him so, but then he hadn't told either of them about his own feelings. Marco couldn't imagine competing with Sandro for Elisabetta, and it was inconceivable that any girl, even she, would come between them.
Class, please take your seats,
Professoressa Longhi said after the song ended.
Let's get started. Take out your essays.
Marco sat down, retrieved his essay from his backpack, and hid his paper so no one would see his handwriting. His letters were large and deformed, as if written by a much younger student. His teachers thought he was sloppy or careless, but the truth was worse. Writing and reading were a struggle for him, even at his age. His classmates could read with ease, even aloud, but every time he looked at a page, the words appeared to him as a collection of nonsensical squiggles, and he had to figure out their meaning from the context or from what the teachers said. He didn't recognize any of the words except for the ones that reoccurred, like Mussolini. And Marco had begun to fear that he was simply born stupid, which shamed him. His grades were falling, and last year one of his teachers had summoned his mother, telling her that he had to study harder. His mother had nagged him and prayed to St. Thomas Aquinas and St. Joseph of Cupertino. But Marco knew he would have been better off with St. Jude, patron saint of lost causes.
Okay, class, let's begin. Who would like to read his essay aloud?
Marco raised his hand, according to one of the stratagems he had devised to hide his deficiency. He would volunteer to read, instead of waiting to be called upon, so he could control when he spoke. Then he would pretend to read his essay aloud, making his eyes move back and forth like the others did, but he would simply be speaking about the subject of the assignment. Marco had an excellent recall, able to remember everything the teacher had said, so he had learned the information, and he loved attention, so he was an entertaining speaker. None of his classmates had guessed his secret so far. But every day he worried that the king of the class would become its buffoon. Last night's homework had been to write an essay entitled Mussolini's Greatness from My Unique Viewpoint, and Professoressa Longhi had explained the assignment was to be a personal essay rather than the generic treatise that filled the new textbooks, showing Il Duce commanding vast crowds, firing a gun, harvesting wheat bare-chested, piloting an airplane in goggles, leaping over obstacles on horseback, swimming, hiking, and even playing with a lion cub.
Marco, said Professoressa Longhi, come read your essay. Sandro, you'll read yours next after Marco.
Marco rose and walked to the front of the class. Then Professoressa Longhi cocked her head as if she had a second thought.
Marco, why don't we do something different this time? Why don't we switch? You read Sandro's essay, and Sandro, you read Marco's.
No, wait, Marco said, his mouth going dry. But it was too late, as Sandro was coming to the front of the class.
Marco, here.
Sandro handed Marco's essay.
Let me have your essay.
I wrote it in a hurry. That's why it's messy.
Marco handed Sandro his essay.
It's perfect, written with passion and vigor.
Sandro smiled, and Marco realized that Sandro was covering for him.
Professoressa Longhi motioned from her desk. Marco, please begin. Read us Sandro's essay.
Okay.
Marco stared at Sandro's assignment, stricken. He recognized a few words, but he couldn't begin to read the essay, which was written in his best friend's neat handwriting. Marco's heart began to pound, and he swallowed hard. He glanced up to see Elisabetta looking at him with a sweet and expectant smile. He couldn't bear her reaction if she found out that he couldn't even read. She loved newspapers and books, and she would never fall in love with him then. She would pity him, and he would be humiliated in front of her.
Marco, Sandro said all of a sudden, I'll read your essay first, if that's okay with you.
Sure,
Marco nodded, his cheeks aflame.
Sandro cleared his throat. As everyone knows, my interest is cycling, and I see Mussolini in that way. Like a cyclist who must keep his balance, no matter the terrain, our leader guides Italy.
Marco listened with astonishment, and Sandro managed to decipher some of Marco's horrible handwriting and made up the rest as he went along, inventing insights about cycling and Mussolini that Marco himself would have thought of. Only a friend who knew him so well could accomplish such a feat, and the class listened to the end, then clapped. Professoressa Longhi nodded.
Marco, that essay was fascinating. Now, Marco, would you read Sandro's?
Certainly.
Marco realized he could make it up too.
Benito Mussolini excels in literature, but particularly in regard to mathematics. Mathematics requires logical adherence to rules, much like fascism itself.
Marco continued, moving his eyes back and forth, and Sandro nodded as if Marco were reading exactly what he had written. Marco finished the essay and bowed with a flourish, and everyone clapped again.
Bravi, boys! Professoressa Longhi beamed. Sandro, that is the most thoughtful analysis I have ever heard.
The boys walked side by side back to their desks. Elisabetta smiled at them both, and Marco sat down, reassured.
He must have been mistaken, and nothing must have happened between her and Sandro that day by the river.
Chapter 8. Sandro, June 1937. Sandro sighed, sitting next to his mother. Night had fallen outside the window, and the dinner table had been set with her best china, silverware, and crystal glasses. His sister had met a new beau in London and was bringing him to dinner tonight, but they were late, and so was Sandro's father, Massimo. His mother was annoyed, for as she always said, tardiness was allowable only in babies born past their due date. His mother, Gemma, was an elegant woman, dressed tonight in a sheath of grey linen with a pearl necklace and matching earrings. She wore her greying hair back in a chic twist, and her eyes were bluish-grey behind her steely glasses, which perched on her long nose. Her face was long, too, but in a refined way, with a neck like a Modigliani painting. She was weary after a long day at the hospital, and Sandra was proud of having a mother who was also a doctor, though the neighbors talked behind their hands about her for not being at home like a proper mother. The aroma of fried conch and roasted potatoes wafted in from the kitchen, where their housekeeper, Cornelia Rossi, was preparing the meal.
"Mamma, can't we eat?"
Sandro asked, his stomach growling.
"Of course not. We'll wait for the others. Dottoressa, I can't keep the first course warm any longer."
Cornelia, a heavy-set widow in her 60s with a cheerful temperament, entered the dining room with a platter. She had been Sandro's nanny, but had stayed on as a housekeeper, and he loved her like a second mother. Her hooded eyes were dark, her nose wide, and her smile omnipresent.
"I understand, thanks."
Sandro's mother shook her head.
"We'll watch it get cold."
Cornelia set the platter on the table.
"Buon appetito. Sandro, I made olive alla scolana."
"Thank you,"
Sandro said. Cornelia was from Ascoli Piceno, and her specialty was its signature dish, breaded olives stuffed with lamb, beef, cheese, vegetables, and seasoning.
"Mamma, please, may I start?"
"Just one."
Sandro popped a fried olive into his mouth, and it exploded with taste on his tongue. The breading was thin, golden brown, and crunchy, and the meat filling had a warm, spicy sweetness.
"Delicious, Cornelia."
"Yes, grazie."
Sandro's mother reached for an olive.
"You're welcome."
Cornelia smiled, then left the room. Gemma turned to Sandro.
"So how was school today?"
"Fine, and I picked up a new assignment from Enzo, Levi Civita's graduate assistant."
"Good."
His mother chewed thoughtfully.
"Are you enjoying the work?"
"Yes, but it's difficult."
"You can do it."
His mother smiled.
"Have you met Levi Civita yet?"
"No, he's always busy in his office."
"Maybe you should introduce yourself. I'm sure he'd love to meet such a brilliant young man."
Sandro chuckled.
"Levi Civita once found an error that Einstein had made in his calculations in his Entwurf paper. Do you really think he would love to meet a fairly able student from a local liceo?"
His mother laughed.
"You could be the next Levi Civita. Did you ever think of that?"
"Perhaps. In my dreams."
Sandro wasn't kidding, for he had dreamed as much.
"You must believe in yourself. Levi Civita chose you, didn't he?"
"He also chose a slew of students from all over the world."
"Still, I'm proud of you."
His mother touched his arm.
"I know you think I'm nagging you, but don't mistake me. I urge you forward not for your own personal ambition, but for something more important. God has given you a magnificent gift in your intellectual abilities, and he did so for a reason. That reason is for you to discover and pursue."
Sandro blinked in surprise, having never heard his mother speak that way, and he knew all of her lectures. He had no immediate response, but the conversation was interrupted by the opening of the apartment door, and it was Sandro's father. Massimo Simone was older than most of the fathers of Sandro's classmates, and his hair, sparsely black with silvery strands, looked windblown. He was of such a short stature that he had been called Minimo in school, so he had sought refuge in his studies, which had led to his profession as a tax lawyer. Sandro's father always told the story to show that one could turn disadvantage to advantage.
"Buonasera, sposa e giovanotto."
His father took off his hat, his dark eyes lively behind his bifocals.
"Sorry I'm late, but the meeting at the synagogue ran long."
His father came over and kissed his mother.
"Guess who's the new general counsel to the board?"
"Not you, is it?"
his mother asked, with indulgent disapproval.
Yes, the very same. Perhaps I'll make something of myself yet.
His father sat down with a wink.
But you're already so busy, Massimo.
Perhaps, but this is important, and I'm needed.
That's wonderful, Papa.
Sandro felt happy for his father. The Jewish community of Rome was governed by a board of 15 men called counselors, who were also responsible for administering its affairs, paying bills, and taking census information. His father had been advising them unofficially on legal matters, spending more and more time at the synagogue, so it was nice to have his role acknowledged, even though Sandro's mother was probably right about his schedule. The door opened again, and at last, Rosa entered on the arm of a tall, red-headed man with bright blue eyes, a nice smile, and freckles. He wore a dark suit of English tailoring, and Rosa seemed in high spirits, in a black dress she saved for fancy occasions.
"Mamma, Papa," she said, "sorry we're late. Everyone, this is David Jacobs. He just started at the embassy."
"Welcome to our home, David."
His father rose and shook the young man's hand.
"Signor Simone, thank you for having me."
David turned to Sandro's mother with a well-mannered nod.
"Dottoressa Simone, thank you too." "Welcome and please sit down. May I serve? The meal's getting cold."
Sandro's mother shot Rosa a look, but Rosa was oblivious, pulling out a chair for David. Sandro thought he had a kind manner, though his Italian sounded schooled, which could be forgiven. They both took their seats, and Rosa winked at Sandro. He was delighted to see the shine in her eyes, but felt a touch regretful. He hadn't mustered the courage to give Elisabetta a gift, having lost any momentum he had gained since their kiss at the river. His father said a prayer over the meal and raised a glass of wine.
"Rosa, tonight is a special occasion. Not only do we have a guest at the table, but I've been elected to the board. Let's toast to Italy's good fortune under me and Mussolini."
Rosa laughed.
"Bravo, Papa."
"That's a surprise," David blurted out.
Sandro's father blinked, and Rosa shot David a warning glance. Silence followed, and they sipped their wine in momentary awkwardness. Sandro's mother began serving everyone, but David turned to Sandro's father.
"Signor Simone, my apologies. My comment didn't sound the way I intended. What I meant was, I'm surprised that you can be Jewish and so ardently fascist."
"Thank you for your apology, but it's unnecessary."
Sandro's father smiled pleasantly.
"As for your confusion, many Jewish families are proud fascists. As a statistical matter, Jews join the party in the same proportion as Gentiles."
David pursed his lips. "My surprise is due to the blatant anti-Semitism of Adolf Hitler in Germany. Doesn't that concern you as a Jew?"
"Yes, but National Socialism has nothing to do with us. We're Italian fascists, and there's no anti-Semitism in Italian fascism. Il Duce was in power for a long time before Hitler even appeared on the scene, not the other way around. Hitler imitates Mussolini, not vice versa."
"Yet Hitler is Chancellor of Germany." Rosa shifted in her chair, and Sandra wondered if she was trying to kick David under the table, like she used to do to him when he was little. His father cleared his throat.
"But that's beside the point. Germany is Germany, and Italy is Italy. We defeated the Germans in the Great War. I myself served as an army officer in the 29th Piedmont Infantry, and many Jewish veterans belonged to our party. We wanted a strong leader, and the economy has grown under Mussolini. He simplified our Byzantine tax laws, and my practice is more robust than ever. I represent many small businessmen, and all of them are doing better."
His father picked up his fork.
"One prominent Jewish banker, Ettore Ovazza, encourages more Jews to become fascists. I may travel to Turin to see him in my newfound capacity."
His mother interjected, "Really, Massimo? When?" David frowned. Signor Simone, the question isn't how you view yourself, but how others view you.
Rosa shifted again in her chair, and this time Sandro spotted David wince.
His father cocked his head.
I can tell you our fellow Italians view us as Italian Jews, which we are. The Simone family is among the most Roman of Romans, and our family's ancestors came to Rome not only before Christ, but before the destruction of the temple.
His father rested his forearms on the table.
Jews have completely assimilated here, as shown by the rate of intermarriage, about 50%. A former prime minister, Luigi Luzzatti, was Jewish, and so was a former mayor of Rome, Ernesto Nathan. I could go on and on, listing prominent Jewish citizens and leaders.
Sandro had heard this speech before. His father kept a running tally of successful Jews, as if keeping score for the home team.
I agree with my husband, his mother interjected.
Thank you, dear.
His father flashed his little smile. A rare victory. Everyone laughed, lightening the mood, and his mother sipped her wine.
David, I never experience antipathy at the hospital, though it's associated with the church. My colleagues feel the same way.
His father added,
And Mussolini is no anti-Semite. He has a Jewish mistress.
Massimo, please.
His mother glanced at Sandro, who already knew what a mistress was, but his father continued.
He lives with her and her daughter. Ovazza told me so. He knows Mussolini personally. Isn't that something?
His mother rolled her eyes.
You're still not going to Turin. You don't have the time.
David nodded.
Then I stand corrected. As a Jew, I never underestimate anti-Semitism.
David, on to brighter topics.
Rosa interrupted him.
Why don't you tell my parents about your family in Gloucestershire? I'm sure they would love to hear.
Chapter 9. Elisabetta, July 1937. After school, Elisabetta changed into her blue and white checked dress for her waitressing job. Enrico watched from the bed, his eyes narrow with resentment. She hadn't had time to give him attention, as she had to finish her housework and make dinner for her father, who had taken to bed.
I'm sorry, Rico.
Elisabetta scratched him, but he didn't forgive her enough to purr. She left the bedroom just as her mother came home with her friend, Giulia Martarano, whom Elisabetta adored. Giulia was as warm and exuberant as her mother was chilly and sour, and Elisabetta always wondered why Giulia remained friends with her mother, who treated her badly, tolerating her rather than enjoying her company. Giulia had big brown eyes, plump cheeks, and an oversized smile, with a face framed by glossy black curls. Her clothes were from a palette that only an art teacher would wear successfully. A blouse of pink and red flowers paired with a voluminous emerald green skirt and a long necklace of mille fiori beads. Elisabetta met them in the kitchen.
Ciao, mamma. Giulia.
Ciao. Her mother looked typically lovely in a white piqué dress that showed her figure to advantage, and she set down her purse with a heavy sigh. Elisabetta knew that her mother wanted to be asked what was wrong, and she was about to do just that when Giulia swept her up in a hug.
How's my girl?
Giulia kissed her, and Elisabetta kissed her back.
I'm good, grazie.
Giulia beamed. You're more beautiful every day. And I loved the essay you wrote. Your mother gave it to me to read.
Oh, how nice.
Elisabetta relished the praise. Last week, she had written an essay entitled On the Necessity of Cats, hoping to submit it to a newspaper and get an internship. She had gotten the idea from Sandro and wanted to try, even though she had never written anything outside of school, except for various letters to the editor, which the newspapers didn't publish. She had wanted to write on a weightier subject, such as the rights of women. But she had noticed that the few female journalists wrote only about domestic life, household tips, or beauty advice. Besides, cats mattered, at least to her. "I had no idea you were such a good writer, dear. Your essay was very clever, and your authorial voice is original." "You're not saying that because you know me, are you?"
"Not at all."
Julia patted her arm.
"Do you think it's good enough to be published?"
"Absolutely. They might even pay you."
"That doesn't matter to me. I would be proud.
It should matter." Elisabetta's mother interrupted her from the chair, where she sat rubbing her feet. "We need money. Be practical."
"I am, Mama."
"No, you're not. You're wasting your time in school." Elisabetta didn't want to fight about school again. She loved learning and wanted to stay until graduation.
"You'll never be a journalist, Elisabetta. They don't hire girls. Anyway, it doesn't pay like waitressing."
"But I don't want to waitress my whole life, and money isn't everything."
"That's your good-for-nothing father talking."
Elisabetta flushed, ashamed when her mother disparaged her father, especially in front of someone else. Her mother resented that her father didn't support their family, even though Elisabetta worked harder than her mother. It was her own waitressing money, not her mother's singing lessons, that paid the rent. But her mother had wanted to become an opera singer, and losing the chance had embittered her. Julia smoothed over the awkward moment, fishing in her purse and handing Elisabetta the essay.
"Here we go. Good luck. Just don't offer it to Il Tevere or Il Popolo. Fascists don't care about a woman's point of view. Or cats."
"Thank you." Elisabetta turned to her mother.
"Mama, what did you think of it?"
"I didn't read it. I told you I was too busy. Did you feed your father?"
"Yes, he's in bed."
"Of course." Her mother sighed heavily again.
"Don't you have to get to the restaurant?"
"Oh, yes." Elisabetta picked up her purse and put the article inside.
"I'd better go. Goodbye."
Her mother nodded, still rubbing her feet.
"Goodbye, dear."
Julia kissed Elisabetta's cheek.
"I hope to see you again soon."
"Me too." Elisabetta left the house, brightening as she stepped outside, since it was impossible to stay glum walking through Trastevere. She loved her neighborhood, with its small houses and pretty pastel facades, and each home unique, with a wrought iron balcony that had ivy dripping down, or a little shrine to the Virgin embedded in a facade, or a window strung with festive colored lights. It felt freer here than in Rome proper, and because the buildings were fewer stories, more sky showed. Twilight was a wash of transparent blue with the stars shimmering behind, waiting for their chance to shine. Elisabetta passed the Basilica di Santa Maria in Trastevere, its graceful arches lighted, illuminating its lovely cornice and gilded mosaics. Taller buildings ringed the cobblestone piazza, and couples held hands or sat kissing on the steps of the fountain. Everyone socialized in the evening during the passeggiata, showing off their most presentable clothes. Girls promenaded in hopes of being seen, and boys did their best to oblige. Elisabetta thought about Marco and Sandro when she kissed her pillow. But after experiencing the real kiss with Sandro, Even her vivid imagination couldn't transform the dryness of the cotton fabric into the remarkable warmth and softness of a boy's mouth. But Sandro hadn't tried to kiss her again, and Marco had been monopolized by Angela and the other girls, all of whom flirted with him. Meanwhile, the teasing about Elisabetta's not having a brassiere had intensified, and Angela had started calling her centesimi, copper pennies, claiming that her nipples showed through her shirt. Now Elisabetta held her books or school bag against her chest at all times. She took a left, winding her way through the narrow streets, approaching the restaurant, Casa Servano. The place wasn't much to look at from the outside, an old converted house with an ugly door of brown wood set in a facade of cracked gray stucco and only a single window. Neither a sign nor a menu was posted, and no one frequented Casa Servano except locals, who knew it served the best homemade pasta in Rome. Since working here, Elisabetta had learned why. She reached the restaurant and let herself into the dining room, which was empty because they weren't open yet. The ground floor of the house fit only 10 tables and on the right, a bar with stools. The ceiling was of embossed tin, and the white stucco walls were adorned with photographs of the Servano family, who had owned the place for generations. At the center of every photo was Nonna Servano, the matriarca. Ciao, Elisabetta. Paolo, Nonna's son, smiled from the bar, where he was drying wine glasses. He was short and skinny, balding even in his 40s, but of a genial manner that served him well as manager and bartender.
Ciao, Paolo. Well, what kind of mood is she in? Good or bad?
Good, so I say agnolotti.
I say tortellini.
Their game was to guess which type of pasta Nonna would be making that night. In a good mood, she would make pasta ripiena, which were stuffed pastas like ravioli, tortellini, and caramelle, as festive as a gift wrapped with fresh dough. In a bad mood, she would make easy types like spaghetti, bigoli, and tagliatelle. Customers who were lucky enough to get a table at Casa Servano ate whichever pasta Nonna had made, for as she often said, only the pilot flies the airplane. Elisabetta reached the kitchen and pushed open the swinging door, greeted by delicious aromas. Paolo's wife, Sofia, labored over a cauldron, slow-cooking thick tomato sauce with meat, seasoned fresh basil, bay leaves, onion, and garlic. Paolo's cousin, Vito, was sautéing garlic. Cousin Nino was filleting branzino. And second cousin Giovanni was scooping hot marrow from a bone. Steam billowed from a massive pot of boiling water, and sinuses were always clear in the kitchen. Elisabetta greeted them and went to the pantry, where Nonna Servano sat making pasta in a high-backed chair at a wooden table, her presence so regal that she transformed a stockroom into a throne room. Her tiny head was shaped like a quail's egg, and her fine white hair was pulled back smoothly into a bun. Her steel-rimmed glasses perched on a beak-like nose, and cataracts had begun to impinge on her dark irises. Wrinkles draped her cheeks and radiated from her thin lips, drawn tight as a rubber band in concentration as she worked. She wore a traditional black dress, a gold necklace with a filigreed crucifix, and earrings of coral drops that stretched her earlobes. Nonna was frail but hardly weak, and she measured only 149 centimeters, but didn't appear small. She looked older than her 67 years, but age hadn't diminished her faculties. On the contrary, she claimed that it had sharpened them, and nobody dared tell her different.
Ciao, nonna. What type of pasta are you making?
Elisabetta kissed her on her cheeks, which felt as soft as sifted flour.
Cappelletti. Sit down, girl. You make me nervous, standing like a lamp post.
Elisabetta sat down. So nonna was in a good mood. But neither Elisabetta nor Paolo had guessed correctly. Atop the wooden table, on a thin dusting of flour, lay flat sheets of dough, yellow with egg yolks, and one of the sheets had been scored into squares with a knife, which rested next to a floured wooden rolling pin, long enough to serve as a cudgel. A mound of pungent ricotta rested in the center of each square, waiting to be formed into shape by Nonna's fingers, still nimble despite her arthritis, perhaps from this very task.
Guarda, Nonna said. Watch.
Nonna picked up the square of dough and folded it into a triangle.
Make sure the edges don't match. Leave a little at the bottom, then press them together and make the seal.
She pushed gently on the dough with her fingertips, leaving the faintest prints.
You see?
Yes. Elisabetta had learned from watching Nonna that there were many different types of pasta and sauces. Pulpy marinara sauce was served with shorter types, which were usually factory made.
Fatto a mano,
homemade pasta, was never served with aglio e olio, oil and garlic, as the pasta absorbed too much oil. Lighter tomato sauces and brodo, broth, were best for ridged cavatelli and radiatori, as they trapped the sauce and a little went a long way.
Now I fold.
Nonna picked up the triangle by one of its corners on the long side, then picked up the other end with her left hand. Holding it between her thumb and forefinger, and with the triangle facing toward her, she slipped her right index finger around the back of the triangle and pushed the bottom upward. In one expert action, she brought the two corners together, pinching them, forming a perfectly round circle of filled pasta with a tiny triangle at the top, looking like a little cap, a cappelletto.
Nonna, that's the way I fold napkins, isn't it?
Elisabetta flashed on Sandro, making her a hat from her newspaper by the Tiber.
No, not at all. You weren't paying attention. I can't stop working to explain everything. The pasta will get hard.
Nonna picked up another square.
I have something important to discuss with you. I have done you a great favor. I've asked a very special guest to dine with us.
Who?
Your future.
What do you mean? Elisabetta had grown accustomed to such mystic pronouncements, as if Nonna were the strega, witch, of Casa Servano.
Moro Gualeschi, a name you will undoubtedly recognize.
Of course I do. Elisabetta adored Gualeschi, whom she read every day. He writes for the leftist papers. How do you know him?
I know everyone. Rather, everyone knows me.
Nonna kept folding pasta.
Leftists, rightists, centrists, no matter. Politics comes and goes. You know what abides?
Love?
No, pasta. I say sapore sapere. To taste is to know. One cannot know me without tasting my pasta. One cannot know Trastevere without tasting our pasta. Likewise, Gualeschi prefers stuffed pasta, so I know he is a man of appetite, one who savors life. I had considered making Cappellacci dei Briganti tonight for him, Why?
Cappellacci dei Briganti is a hat with a wide brim that flips up, like the Briganti used to wear after the unification. I didn't make it because Gualeschi wouldn't have gotten the joke. Communists lack humor.
Nonna folded another piece of pasta with her floured fingertips, and the yellow cappelletti lined up in front of her, awaiting her command. In the next moment, the door swung open, and Paolo popped his head into the kitchen.
Mamma, he said, he is here.
Elisabetta jumped up.
Gualeschi is out there now. May I meet him?
You must.
Thank you,
Elisabetta squealed.
Don't embarrass me.
Nonna's hooded gaze shifted sideways.
By the way, you need a brassiere.
Elisabetta reddened.
I'm trying.
Ascolta. I told Gualeschi that you wrote an article, and he agreed to read it.
My article? How did you know about my article?
You never shut up about it. Do you think I'm deaf? Send it to him.
I have it with me, in my purse.
Then show it to him.
Do you really think I should?
I just said you should.
Nonna dusted flour from her fingertips.
I told him you're a magnificent writer.
But you haven't read it. What if it's no good?
Have you read what they print?
Nonna pinched another cappelletto.
I told him to hire you immediately. People are always wondering what young people think. Mistakenly, in my view. But there you have it.
She brushed flour from knobby fingers.
Go meet him. Don't go on and on like you do. Get to the point. You're too talkative.
Thank you. Thank you.
Elisabetta retrieved her article and headed for the kitchen door.
Wait. What does he look like?
Like a rigatone.
Elisabetta hurried off, pushed through the kitchen door, and glanced around. Several tables were occupied with couples, but seated alone near the door was a dark-haired man with heavy glasses who was short and wide. A rigatone, indeed. She beelined for Gualeschi's table. Her heart beat harder, and she realized that she could be taking the first step toward writing for a real newspaper. She wondered if she would look back on this day and tell this as a funny story, sitting at a table with her fellow journalists. If Sandro could have a brilliant future, then perhaps so could she. Starting right this minute. She reached Gualeschi's table.
Signor Gualeschi, my name is Elisabetta d'Orfeo, and I admire your writing very much. I read you every day, and your article yesterday was especially interesting.
She remembered Nonna's advice not to talk too much.
I'm sorry, I talk a lot, I know. It's just that I have so many thoughts.
You can never go wrong praising a writer for his writing.
Gualeschi blinked with amusement behind his glasses.
But everyone must praise you, all the time.
Not enough for my satisfaction, or with sufficient specificity. My mother thinks my apartment is too big, but I fill it with my ego.
Gualeschi chuckled.
In any event, thank you for your kind praise. I understand you've written a piece for submission. You may send it to my attention at the newspaper.
I have it with me, in fact.
Elisabetta held out her essay, and Gualeschi accepted it with a smile.
Excellent. I will read it during my meal, and we can discuss it afterward. If you have a spare moment.
I would like that very much.
Suddenly, the door of the restaurant burst open and slammed back against the wall, rattling the framed photographs. Standing in the doorway was Elisabetta's father, so drunk that he had to brace his hand on the wall to keep from falling over.
Papa!
Elisabetta's face flamed. Gualeschi grimaced, recoiling, as her father lurched toward her.
Betta, my darling, look at you. I came to see if you had a few lire for me. Do you?
Elisabetta felt mortified in front of Gualeschi.
Papa, no, please.
I only need enough for a glass of red, or perhaps you can offer me one on the house.
Her father looked around, stumbling, and the diners turned to watch. Her father tripped, and Elisabetta opened her arms just as he fell into them, a dead weight that knocked her off balance.
Oh, no.
Elisabetta struggled to stay upright, and Gualeschi leapt to his feet and took her father's arm.
Allow me,
the journalist said, dropping the essay.
My Betta is so pretty, so smart, and I love her so. She's my darling angel.
Her father mumbled, oblivious. Then he started to cough. Elisabetta realized what was going to happen. In the next moment, her father vomited on her and Gualeschi, and on her essay, which lay forgotten on the floor.
Chapter 10. Marco. July 1937. Marco rode on Lungotevere Aventino under a dark sky after Aldo had departed to see his secret girlfriend. The full moon was as round as a bicycle wheel, and lamps shone along the length of the Tiber. A fishy breeze blew off the water, and its rushing sounds soothed him. He spotted a gelateria and headed toward it, then dismounted and went inside. A few people were in line, and the brightly lit place smelled of chilled fruit, sugar, and fresh cream. A glistening aluminum display case dominated the shop, and behind it two pretty girls scooped gelato. Marco looked over the mounds of green pistacchio, rich brown cioccolato, and the happy yellow of ananas or pineapple. Each had a handwritten sign that he couldn't read, but he didn't need to, and he could never decide which flavor. His current favorite was nocciola, hazelnut, and before that his favorite had been fior di latte, made from cream. Elisabetta loved cioccolato in a cone, and she never changed. May we help you? The shop girls asked in unison when Marco reached the counter. Yes, I can't decide which. Take your choice. The shop girl smiled slyly. We're both off at 11. The other shop girl flushed. Teresa! That's a very generous offer. Marco smiled, but he wasn't tempted. He took this as a sign of maturity, or perhaps he had lost his mind due to his utter celibacy. Nevertheless, he made his ice cream choice in Elisabetta's honor. I'll take two scoops of cioccolato in a cone. Gelato in hand, Marco paid and left. He licked his dessert, which tasted creamy and sweet, then he hopped on his bicycle, steering with one hand. The gelato began melting, so he looked for a place to stop. He found himself in the Centro Storico, the oldest part of the city, near the Roman Forum on Via dell'Impero, which was being expanded to showcase the ruins under Mussolini's plan. The area was under excavation, avoided by most of the traffic, which meant it would be quiet. So he rode in that direction. He reached a wooden fence that was more a suggestion than a barrier, like most in the city. He got off his bike, draped it against the fence, then climbed through an opening and looked for a place to sit down. The excavation site was a gigantic hole, shaped like a square and shored on all sides by retaining walls of wooden planks. At the bottom of the hole was a floor of gray-white marble, glimmering in the moonlight. Marco stood and ate as his eyes adjusted to the darkness. He had ridden through this district many times, but it had never been excavated before, and it intrigued him. He noticed a rope strung across railroad ties serving as a staircase to the bottom. So he finished his gelato, went over, and descended. The rich smell of earth filled his nose, and the air cooled as he went deeper. The sounds of the city receded into the distance, as the walls cocooned the sight in silence. Marco neared the bottom, where the marble floor seemed to collect and reflect the moonlight, creating a spectral haze that hovered like the ghosts of the ancients. He marveled at the phenomenon, and the hairs stood up on the back of his neck when he reached the bottom, standing in the soft glow of light all around him. He walked along the floor, amid massive sections of columns that lay on their sides, some with florets carved into the marble and others with fragments of lettering. He ran his hand along their gritty surface and scanned the broken sections. Marco couldn't read Latin any better than Italian, but for the first time, it didn't bother him. He wedged his finger into one of the letters to measure its depth, and the marble came up to his first knuckle. He withdrew his hand, overcome with awe. He had always known that there was a subterranean Rome, a city underneath the city itself, having learned as much in school and encountered random artifacts all over the city. But being here tonight made it real to him in a way it had never been before. He finally understood its meaning and felt his spirit soar. His ancestors had chiseled these letters, carved these columns, and constructed this magnificence. He couldn't read as well as his classmates, but now he knew he possessed native intelligence, as he was descended from these ancients. He was a son of Lazio, of Roma, and he stood tall, bathing in the moon glow, for a very long time. Chapter 11. Aldo, July 1937. Across town, Aldo hurried down the frigid hallway of the catacomb and reached a cubiculo, a small room containing a family crypt. There the anti-fascist sat on the floor around a few lighted candles, bottles of Chianti, and loaves of rustic bread. The men were of all ages, shapes, and sizes, but each face wore a similarly tense expression. Each man knew he was running a lethal risk in being here, so much so that for security reasons, they didn't reveal their true identities even to each other, but used nomi di battaglia, battle nicknames. The names were based on their appearance or demeanor, such as Bug Eyes, Chubby Cheeks, Broken Tooth, Apple Eater, and Pipe Smoker, or less obvious ones like Speaks French and The Tsar. Aldo was called Signor Silenzio, and their leader went by Uno, self-appointed and self-named. Aldo didn't know anything about him, but surmised from Uno's demeanor and vocabulary that he was an intellectual of privileged background. Uno was tall and lean, with thoughtful brown eyes behind his horn-rimmed glasses, and his fine nose was set in a smooth face with high cheekbones and small lips. His Italian was without dialect, though its inflection sometimes sounded Milanese to Aldo, who had heard a similar inflection from Milanese customers at the bar. It made Aldo feel geographically inferior to Uno, for snobs often said that Rome was only a Mediterranean city, but Milan was a European city. Ciao, Signor Silenzio. Uno rose quickly, shaking his hand. The rest of the men joined in, greeting Aldo.
Here, Signor Silenzio.
Uno's wife, whom they called Silvia, smiled and passed him a bottle of wine. She was the only female in the anti-fascist cell, and Aldo felt shy around her, as with most women, especially because she was pretty. She had on a purple frock of a fine cut, and her bright blue eyes and straight blonde hair evinced a northern Italian heritage. Aldo assumed she was Milanese too. But she said little, and Uno did all the talking.
Grazie.
Aldo sat down on the cold, hard floor of the crypt. Uno remained standing, his face barely illuminated by the candlelight below and his shadow elongated on the crypt wall. Now that we're all here, I will begin by saying that this is our most important meeting yet.
As you know, so far we have engaged only in acts of sabotage against the regime, printing and distributing leaflets to convince others of the merits of our cause, or damaging cars, supplies, and other equipment. However, I have come to regard these as vandalism and mischief, not amounting to anything. I have been making new plans. Tonight, I wish to announce them.
Yes, it was mischief at best,
Loudmouth shouted, and Bug Eyes and the Tsar exchanged significant glances, then nodded. Aldo wasn't sure he agreed with Uno, since he had distributed leaflets, and even that had unnerved him. He had risked arrest if caught, and his father would have killed him. Uno paused. Men, we are about to strengthen our resistance. We are ready to intensify our efforts. It is time to take the next step, one that executes our goal to free Italy from the tyranny of fascism. I have decided to call it Operation First Strike. The men looked grave and shifted forward, and Aldo detected a dangerous undercurrent among them, one that he had been worried about for some time. He was the newest member of the cell, having been recruited by Broken Tooth after a chance meeting on the street, but he had begun to realize that Uno and many others were more militant in their views. Aldo took a swig of Chianti, hoping to allay his anxiety. Uno straightened. Now, I propose that we intensify our efforts. We know that the Fascio, the local office of the Fascist Party, is under the command of Comandante Spada. I have reason to believe that Spada has decided to retire, and there is talk of a retirement party for him. It is tentatively scheduled to be held at the Belladonna restaurant around the corner from the Palazzo Braschi headquarters. Excitement ripped through the men, and Loudmouth shouted, "How do you know all of this, Uno? Is the information reliable?" "Yes, it is," Uno answered, then frowned. "But I cannot divulge how I have learned it for your own safety. Now, as I was saying, all of the top party brass will be at the retirement party, presenting us with an opportunity that we must seize. I propose we attack that night and take them all down at once."
"Bravo!"
Loudmouth cheered, and the others erupted in agreement, a collective release of pressure, like a steam valve. Aldo didn't join them, and his gut clenched. Operation First Strike required murder, plain and simple. Murder was a mortal sin. He had never done anything remotely violent. He didn't want to, and he didn't know if he could. He took another swig of wine, but it didn't help. Uno quieted them, his expression darkening. "I know it seems like a long time from now, but it will take that much to prepare Operation First Strike. There are 21 of us, and by then I hope we will grow in number. We are more than up to the challenge, and I will reveal the details of my plan in due course. We will assign tasks, drill with weapons, and rehearse every particular. We will do everything possible to succeed and guard our own safety. Our goal is victory without the loss of even a single man. Do you agree, men?"
"Agree!"
Loudmouth shouted again, and everyone but Aldo joined in. Uno nodded, smiling. "It gladdens my heart to hear you say so. I fault no man who does not want to go forward. We welcome differing views, unlike our enemies. Men, is there anyone who disagrees? If so, please so state, and we will discuss it in a rational manner."
"We all agree,"
Loudmouth hollered. And the others shouted their agreement and pumped their fists, stirring the air so much that the flames wiggled atop the candles. Uno raised a finger. "Excellent, but I want to hear from each of you individually. Unanimity is important, for tonight we form a sacred pact. Loudmouth, do you agree?"
"Yes, I say yes."
"Good. Bug Eyes?" Uno turned to Bug Eyes, who answered yes. Then Uno went around the circle asking each man, and each agreed. Aldo grew more and more nervous as his turn came closer. Murder was against everything he had been taught, and he feared for his eternal soul. He had been an altar boy, and his brother Emedio was a priest. Aldo believed in his faith with all his heart, and he went to mass every morning with his mother. He couldn't imagine killing a human being.
uno item. Signor Silenzio, do you agree? Aldo hesitated.
Uno, this is a significant escalation for us, don't you think?
Yes, but do you disagree?
Well, I was caught unawares. I'm trying to decide.
Kindly tell us your thinking.
Uno smiled, and Aldo became aware that everyone was turning to him. So he suppressed his jitters and spoke his mind.
Uno, I believe in our cause, but I am a man of faith. Murder is a mortal sin. It's against the commandment, thou shalt not kill. I love God and follow his word.
Uno blinked, and the men recoiled, frowning. Loudmouth hissed, "Coward!" Uno's head snapped to Loudmouth, and he scowled at him. "No name calling, let the man speak." Loudmouth scowled back.
"I'm not a coward," Aldo said,
grateful that the leader would defend him.
"But distributing pamphlets is one thing, and murder quite another."
The men stiffened, and Aldo sensed his words were giving them pause. Uno nodded thoughtfully. "Signor Silenzio, I respect your religious beliefs, as we all do, for we are faithful too. Yet the Church teaches that killing is not a sin if necessitated in a just war. That is exactly what we are engaged in, a just war against fascism."
Uno kept his tone soft, not argumentative, and he eyed the men in the circle, addressing them too.
"Every day Mussolini and his regime oppress our fellow citizens and lead our beloved country farther down the path to war. Yet his wars are not just, are they? Ethiopia was not a just war. Worse, we all know that he used poison mustard gas on those poor souls, and that is an atrocity. His goal is the death and destruction of anyone who doesn't follow him."
The men nodded, but didn't interrupt Uno. "Consider the countless lives we will save and the human losses we will prevent if we undertake Operation First Strike. The local fascio supports the party in our city. Palazzo Braschi is arguably the most important local party office in the country. Can you imagine what good we will do if we cut the head off of the snake? Could there be a war more just?"
Aldo mulled it over, torn. His brain told him that Uno might be correct, but his faith told him that murder was the most grievous of sins. He wished he could pray over the matter and contemplate. He had never been so confused, and he didn't like being the odd man out, the only one arguing with Uno. The other anti-fascists were narrowing their eyes at him, even Broken Tooth. Aldo felt their judgment, and he feared they would think him disloyal. So he succumbed to the pressure of the moment. This was neither the time nor place for a crisis of conscience.
"Uno, okay, then. I see it your way," Aldo managed to say.
"I have persuaded you of the correctness of our cause?"
"Yes, absolutely."
Uno beamed. "Then we move as one."
"Bravo!"
Everyone cheered, their faces alive with animation and their fists pumping again.
Uno raised an index finger, silencing them.